Welcome. Thank you very much. It is 10:30. This is one of the last sessions of the RIC. Thank you all for showing up and being here today. We appreciate it. So, good morning and welcome to today's session on global approaches to using social media to keep the public informed about nuclear safety. My name is Holly Harrington. I am the senior level advisor in the Office of Public Affairs at the NRC. So on behalf of the agency, I welcome all of our panelists to the 31st Regulatory Information Conference, and I express our appreciation for your willingness to share your expertise and insights with us. So please allow me to begin by introducing my panel. Sebastian Huber is head of communications at Switzerland's Federal Nuclear Safety Inspectorate, ENSI. Gino Munsami is manager of corporate communications and stakeholder relations at the South Africa National Nuclear Regulator. Qi Wei is section chief at Taiwan's Atomic Energy Council, responsible for public participation and communication of nuclear safety issues. And Stephanie West is a public affairs specialist at the NRC's Office of Public Affairs and a colleague of mine. So let me, before we begin the panel, let me set the stage a little bit. So the Nuclear Energy Agency will soon be publishing a second social media report titled Nuclear Regulatory Organizations and the Evolving Use of Social Media as a Communication Tool. I was fortunate enough to lead the team that researched and wrote the report, which included surveys of social media usage by nuclear regulatory organizations. So the statistics we found as we were doing our research, as they related to the global importance and reach of social media, was astonishing. In 2017, there were some 3.8 billion, billion with a B, internet users, and 2.8 billion active social media users globally. In these cases, that was an increase of 10% and 20% respectively over the previous year. So a very steep upward trajectory. Facebook and YouTube were two of the most frequently used social media platforms globally, with 1.8 billion and 1 billion users respectively. Excuse me. So these are astonishing numbers that communicators at nuclear regulatory organizations around the world cannot ignore. And indeed, they don't. Based on a survey of the members of the NEA working group that developed the report, 70% of NROs use at least one social media platform. What we found, though, and it was echoed not just in the survey that we did, but in three NEA workshops that we held in Europe, North America, and Asia, is that countries don't necessarily use the same platforms, nor is the content that they distribute via the platforms similar. Cultural norms and customs greatly influence social media usage. So today, we'll explore that more, thanks to the presentations of our panelists. Today's panel underscores the importance the NRC places on international activities. Such activities allow us to solidify our relationships with regulators around the globe and work to enhance nuclear safety and security worldwide. Sharing information, knowledge, and technical expertise with our international counterparts contributes to our success and to our commitment to continuous improvement. Sharing best practices with our international communication colleagues is an important way for the NRC to expand its understanding of how the world communicates about nuclear safety. So as I mentioned, the NRC participates in NEA's Working Group on Public Communication. We also participate in the communication network of the IAEA's Global Nuclear Safety and Security Network. Through both, we share NRC experience and learn from other communicators. I hope our discussion today will do the same. So I have a few housekeeping items before we start. I was told that there might be a safety slide, but honestly, on the third day of the conference, if you don't know the safety stuff by now, I'm not going to tell it to you again. Please silence your phones, if you would. If you need to step out, please do so quietly through the back doors. We will have a question and answer after all the panelists are done with their presentations. If you have a question, and we hope you will have a question, please write it on cards. I understand they're around, and we've got several volunteers, wave your hands, thank you, who will take your cards and then bring them up to us. And we do also appreciate your feedback at the end of this session and on the conference as a whole. So there is an evaluation feedback form available out by registration. You'll also get an email, I'm told, so you can fill it out online if you wish. So I would now like to introduce our first speaker. Sebastian Huberre has been head of communications at the Federal Nuclear Safety Inspectorate, or ENSI, since 2011. He previously worked as a journalist and editor, including 8 years at the Swiss news agency, SDAATS. Okay. He also is the chairman of my working group, the past chairman of my working group, and he's done that from 2017 to just recently. He's also a member of the program committee for the International Symposium on Communicating Nuclear and Radiological Emergencies to the Public at the IAEA in Vienna last October. His full bio and all the bios of the panelists are available online. Sebastian.
Thank you, Holly. Welcome also from my side. It's always interesting to be here and to talk about communication. Communication is a quite important aspect in our work as regulators. And I have the impression that, especially since Fukushima, the regulatory bodies also realized that communication is not just something we do also because we have to do it, but communication has also a safety aspect, that we have an influence on safety with our work. We're talking about social media, and I would like to show you with a small case study the chances and challenges on social media we have in Switzerland. So let's dive into the case study. First, some key figures. The Swiss Federal Nuclear Safety Inspectorate, ENSI, has about 150 employees. In communication, we are 4.2 full-time equivalents, and we are active on social media since 2011. Fukushima triggered this in our organization. Switzerland has 5 reactors and 4 power plants. The oldest one is Betzna 1 in the northwest of Switzerland, and I will talk about Betzna 1. It's in operation since 1969, and it is a pressure water reactor. While carrying out ultrasonic measurements of the pressure vessel in Betzna 1 in 2015, in the summer of 2015, there were flow indications detected in this pressure vessel. And these flow indications required a closer evaluation. So the power plant was shut down for these evaluations. And these evaluations, or these ultrasonic measurements, were a result of Doel and Tihange in Belgium. There they found also findings in the pressure vessel in 2012. Three years later, the operator was able to prove that the pressure vessel was safe, that these flow indications didn't have any negative influence on the safety of the power plant. And ENSI informed on March 6, 2018, with a comprehensive package, information package, the public about this decision that the power plant could restart again. It was a media conference. We had various articles on our website, and we were also very active on social media. Last remark before we dive into this case study. We had a referendum at the end of 2016, about phasing out nuclear power in Switzerland. And after this referendum, all the safety questions on nuclear are not any more real a topic in Swiss public. So let's see how is ENZ working with social media. We are on Twitter, we are on Facebook, we are on LinkedIn, among a few others, but I want to talk about these three channels. We have in Switzerland about 8.5 million people living in this country, and if we look compare this with the followers and subscribers on our social media channels, you will see that the number is quite small. But these numbers can grow big. 2 weeks after our press conference, we gave the power plants the permission to restart again, and we also communicated on that topic. Our web article was read by 620 people. Not very much if you see 8.5 million people in Switzerland. We published it also on Twitter, on Facebook, and on LinkedIn. And if you summarize all these numbers, we have more than 15,000 people seeing our message. And if you compare this with what we had on our website, social media had quite an impact. So what does that mean? Does that mean let's forget the website and publish in the future only on social media? I don't think so. Website and social media must complement each other. Web articles are still available long time after they are published. With search engine optimization, these articles can be found via Google or other search engines. Social media posts are just there at the moment that you post them, and then they disappear in your timeline and are not found so easily anymore. It's, from my point of view, it's a combination of both that work. It's also important, and what is also important is not primarily the quantity, but the quality of the people who read this. What does that mean? We reach, with our posts, for example, members of the parliament. We reach journalists, and those are quite important decision makers and multipliers of our information. In addition, it is also of an eminent importance for a crisis situation that communication channels are established. We saw that, for example, with Fukushima. So again, my conclusion is we need social media as an equal respected information channel. The overall package of our channels makes communication strong. Thank you.
Thank you, Sebastian. I'm going to steal the mic back. Okay. So our second speaker today is Gino Moonsamy. He is the Corporate Communications and Stakeholder Relations Manager at the South Africa National Nuclear Regulator, or NNR, and the Deputy Information Officer for the National Nuclear Regulator of South Africa. With a career spanning over 20 years across various portfolios in the public sector, Gino has vast experience in strategy, multicultural communications, advocacy, public affairs, public relations, brand building, and project management. Gino is also the steering committee chair of the IAEA's Global Nuclear Safety and Security Communication Network. Gino.
Thank you, Holly. Good morning. I'm going to speak about social media in Africa, and I'm also going to take this opportunity to reflect on a case study of social media usage concerning nuclear safety in South Africa. And lastly, I will touch upon the Global Nuclear Safety and Security Network. Coincidentally, the Internet celebrated its 30th birthday on the 12th of March, this Tuesday, 30 years old. And if I recall one of the presentations by one of the commissioners, there's 2% of the NRC staff that are under 30. So these are just some interesting facts. The social media has been around for probably 22 years. And then, so let me kick into my presentation. In my speech, we'll talk about the African perspective, the South African perspective, the case study, and we'll go into the GNSS.com. In order for social media to take place, you need the Internet. The social media cannot happen without the Internet. Now, in advanced economies, the Internet and infrastructure for the Internet is readily available. Africa is a developing economy. The scenario is slightly different. There are some countries that have advanced infrastructure and some not so advanced. Coupled with that infrastructure challenge is the challenge of getting access. With that comes connectivity, with that comes devices, and with that there's an additional challenge of cost, data cost, et cetera, et cetera. In Africa, the social media platform serves an opportunity for marginalized communities to have a voice and a share of voice. One can argue and debate, is having social media a human right? Is having access to social media a human right? And there's a very interesting dynamic around that. Is having access does not necessarily mean that you'll have the information. So those that are responsible in the public service for making decisions on behalf of the broader public and decisions in terms of nuclear power, in terms of nuclear safety, need to share the information. And then there's a perspective of openness and transparency. How open and how transparent do we want to be? Africa is quite unique in that we have a notorious track record for government shutting down social media. When this happens, government gives the excuses of national security, elections, protests, school exams, and visits by governments of officials. How believable is that? One can interrogate it. It's highly questionable. Is this abuse of power? It reminds me of back of home, you know, when my 10-year-old is being reprimanded by my wife, and she say, no, I'll switch off the Wi-Fi or I'll cut off the data, you know? And I'm yet to hear my 10-year-old say, you know, but it is my right. And then I think it's coming, though. I think it's coming. So when we're going to be faced with that, it'll be an interesting discussion at home. And then I'd like to hear mom's side of it. There's advantages and disadvantages, and it depends which lens you put on for shutting down the Internet, shutting down social media. But the repercussions are great. And the repercussions primarily in the nuclear safety space or in public administration is the erosion of public trust and confidence in the authorities that do that. There was a recent incident in Zimbabwe across the border from South Africa where there was a lot of unrest and the Minister of Finance, in the absence of the Prime Minister, shut down the Internet. And the public was up in arms and uproar. Guess about what? About why did the Minister of Finance shut it down and not the Prime Minister? Because in terms of the legislation within the country, it was not the minister's responsibility to do that. So when the prime minister got back from his duty travel, he reinstated the internet and everything went back to normal. In South Africa, we have a unique situation. There is two scenarios that I'd like to discuss very briefly. The first scenario was in 2015, at the State of the Nation address, the ruling party decided to jam the mobile signals coming out of the parliamentary house. And that did not go well because South Africa has a track record for being a leader in democracy in the African region. And that really hurt the reputation and caused damage to the ruling party. On the flip side, the students' activism used social media to lobby government to create free access for poor students to study at universities. This campaign was it's one of the much talked about campaigns in the African region, because it was done responsibly, but it reached very widespread audiences, and the messaging was very, very powerful and strong, coupled with activism in the street. So there were two scenarios. One was a negative and one was a positive. So the government then took a stance to fund previously disadvantaged students at the rate that the government can afford and create access to that, to education. It goes against the grain of money can't buy education. And I'm sure we're seeing some recent controversial issues. That's another debate. Coming back to South Africa. South Africa has one nuclear power plant, and it is the only commercial nuclear power plant in the African continent. It's located in the southern tip of Africa, a very beautiful part of the world for those that have been there. But the Cape itself is renowned for the Cape of Storms and the Cape of Fires, in that it is prone to fell fires in the autumn season, and it's a very windy region. And then also it has these violent storms. Now, an issue arose in 2016 on the Kuberg nuclear power station site, where there is the nature reserve, and there was a fire that took place, and the fire spread across to the other area of the nature reserve. This is within the emergency planning zone, so it wasn't an off-site issue. However, for those that are living within the emergency planning zone, it became a serious concern. How did they respond? Obviously, we had the disaster management agencies in there. We had the Kuberg comms team using social media during the event to inform and keep everyone posted and updated. And this was a turning point in terms of managing communications during an event for the South African facility and the regulator. In that, traditionally, we would use a press conference to share information with the public. In this case, it was in real time throughout the event, and then a press conference took place after the social media interventions. These were some basic stats. We had quite a few people on Twitter, Facebook. Yeah, that's it. So, in South Africa, the most popular platforms that are being used, as I mentioned, is Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and now Instagram. There's approximately 16 million people, active users, and there is approximately 14 million mobile users. Now, coming back to my last slide, and Holly mentioned this earlier on about the USNRC funding one of the funders of this Global Nuclear Safety and Security Network. This is a network established by the IAEA. It's primarily a resource tool to build capacity within all the member states and interested operators to empower and build the communication skills. Now, currently what's trending and what's topical is the use of social media. So We had very good. We have a steering committee that's steering this network, and to see how it can offer the resources to help member states and globally, across the globe, to harmonize and align communications. An accident in Africa is an accident in the U.S. It affects the entire world. And communication is not a luxury. You will see in my talk, I've touched on various aspects that will impact on legislation, that will impact on communication capacity, because communication is not a standalone. Social media cannot operate without legislation. If it does, then you'll get government shutting down, et cetera, violating human rights. And this network is a handy resource tool to help communicators improve and harmonize communications globally. I thank you.
You will hand that over. Thank you. So, Gino, thank you. Our third speaker is Chi Wei Ping, who serves as Section Chief in the Atomic Energy Council, or AEC, in Taiwan. His tasks involve assistance on public participation and communication for nuclear safety issues, as well as supervision and evaluation of organizational effectiveness. In 2012, he promoted a smartphone app called Nuclear Safety Live Messenger, which allows users to monitor current environmental radiation levels and information on nuclear power plants. If you're not going to talk about it, I'm going to ask you about it. His experience spans public outreach involving science and a risk-informed approach to nuclear safety. Chi Wei began his career in 1994 as a technical specialist at the Department of Planning in Taiwan and later as chief of the Education and Development section. Chi Wei.
Thank you. Okay. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. At first, I'd like to appreciate this opportunity to share our experience in keeping the public informed about safety, nuclear safety in Taiwan. Okay. Here's my outline. In the first part of, I would like to talk about the background about what public thinks. And the second part, I will introduce three approaches that we use to communicate with the public, and then my conclusion. Okay. Let me remind you, on March 11 of 2011, the explosion of Fukushima accident, everybody saw that on the media, no matter the live news or web streaming. I think the public might believe the nuclear power is a fierce scourge. So in Taiwan, our present ruling party proposed the nuclear-free homeland policy. As you can see in the diagram, the share of the nuclear power will decrease to zero by 2025. Also, the policy has been implemented into the Electricity Act. But the paragraph 1, Article 95, have been abolished in accordance with the provision of the Referendum Act. We have the referendum last December. You can see the content of the Proposition 16. You may wonder why public change their ground. I think maybe it's the hard issue or the hard question to answer. Maybe I will try to explain by the survey that conducted just at the same time. And now you can see two results of the survey. On your left side, the question is asking about the, do you know most Taiwanese think about our energy come mainly from? You could see the 43.6% people think the nuclear power is the main source of our electricity, but the true, it is only 8%. On your right side, you can see more than half of the Taiwanese are unfamiliar about the government's renewable energy target for 2025. Okay. Maybe the survey told us our government have to put more effort to improve public understanding of our energy issues and to gain more public support in our energy transition plan. And then I would like to show the second part of my presentation. Here's the three approaches we used to recently to communicate with the public. The first one is the policy participation platform. This platform is set by our cabinet. Any citizen in Taiwan could raise a proposal on the platform. The platform is set on the internet. And then receiving 5,000 signatures, and then it will transfer to the associate agency to hold the stakeholders meeting and make an open response within limited period. The second one, a public participation platform, is set up by ourselves. Actually, the platform is not the real platform, it's the operational mechanism. All of our regulatory activities, including open meetings and inspection activities, are requested to invite general public to attend the discussion. The third one is, I think the more interesting one is our fan patch. Actually, the target of the fan patch is to promote our popular knowledge about the nuclear energy. Okay. Here's my conclusion. Maybe, actually, Atomic Energy Council in Taiwan, we are doing almost the same thing as the NRC is doing nuclear safety regulatory. So our working principle, I think, maybe the providing an open, transparent information to the general public is our highest principle to gain the public trust in our government. But also we could notice the exploded information over social media, and we start to pay attention to the spread of misinformation. And I like to end up my words with Ralph Emerson's word, fear always springs from ignorance. Maybe general public's fear is come from unfamiliar with the nuclear power, but also the fear of it is what has the power. Maybe I would say the power encouraged us to face and to ease the public's fear with openness, transparency, and accountability. Okay. And last, I'd like to appreciate the time you took to our presentation. Thank you. Thank you much.
Thank you, Chi-Wei. Our final panelist is Stephanie West. She is a public affairs specialist in the Office of Public Affairs here at the NRC. She has been a key player on the NRC social media team for the past 7 years. She manages the agency's Facebook page and Twitter account. She plans and creates content. She also monitors social media, reports on social media traffic and conversations related to us as well as related to the commercial nuclear industry. Stephanie.
Thank you. Let me go back here real quick. Sorry about that. A good portion of my job, as Holly mentioned, is the day-to-day work to cultivate and maintain the NRC's social media presence. So that's what I'm going to talk about, our specific approach at the NRC to establishing ourselves as a reliable source for what is often very complicated and technical information, but doing that in an environment where things like levity, brevity, and social connection are highly valued. So just a quick example of the levity or the humor you often find on social media. In late 2017, I put up a Facebook post using this graphic. So the aim of the post was to point people out to our public website where they could get a look at the electronic version of the NRC's information digest. and to also demonstrate how the public can be involved in the license renewal process. So I know the graphic is quite busy, which probably explains this comment. Daryl says, it looks like a really sad board game with no end and no winners. So he was right about, I chuckled about that for quite a long time and shared it with all my colleagues. So just quickly, I wanted to go over the tools that we're using at the NRC. Facebook and Twitter are our primary tools for pushing information out to the public. We also have a YouTube channel and a Flickr page where we can easily share videos, graphics, and images, and of course cross-post back to Twitter and Facebook whenever we have the opportunity. So I put up some high-level stats here so you can have a sense of how often we're posting to these platforms and the size of our audience. So you can see by our numbers that we're no real threat to pop star Katy Perry's 107 million followers on Twitter, but we'll keep plugging away at that. So when we're talking about something as serious and important as nuclear safety, credibility, of course, is key. And we're confident in NRC's experts and the work that they do, and our social media tools help us convey our commitment to safety and transparency. So you have to, though, be able to get people to tune in to get them interested in what you're posting. So we try to offer balanced content at the NRC. So in addition to posting about the day-to-day regulatory business of our agency, like news releases or inspection information or public meeting notices, we also try to, be a little bit creative and have some fun when it's appropriate. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But in keeping with the title of the presentation, Community Quizzes and Crisis, these are three categories or types of posts that we use to help us with that balanced content concept that I'm going to be talking about. So first up is community. So what I mean by that is our efforts to help our audience get to know the people of the NRC. We're not a faceless bureaucracy only churning out regulations. We're an organization made up of dedicated professionals who care about nuclear safety and who are spending their careers in service to the public. So just a few examples of a community-type post. This first one is some of our folks in our Region 3 office in the Midwest went out to a local business expo, a community event near a nuclear plant. So they had the opportunity to talk to members of the public about nuclear safety at that plant. The second example here is one of five posts that we did during Public Service Recognition Week in this past year. So we had an opportunity to highlight and recognize employees from our headquarters office as well as our regional offices. This post here is from a post we did recently over the holidays. I can see Commissioner Burns in the audience here.
Right there.
So our commission office sponsored an event for charity. So you can see in this photograph Commissioner Burns and Caputo's making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And they both took their techniques very seriously. But this was an opportunity, a community-type post, something lighter that we could put up during the holidays. This last example is a screenshot from a video series we have on our YouTube channel called 3 Minutes With, where we've sat with NRC professionals and asked them questions about the work that they do and how it supports the agency's mission. So we're hoping that these types of posts help build trust with our audience by focusing and emphasizing on the human element of our agency. So that brings us to quizzes. So this is where we get to have a little fun, or I get to have a little fun, and be creative. So when we're not informing people about our current regulatory activities, we're trying to educate them about things like nuclear regulation, plant operation, or nuclear science. So our social media tools are handy in this effort because they sort of help us disguise education as entertainment. So this first one is an example of a series that I created for Facebook and I'm now using on Twitter called Guess the Nuclear Term. So these are really short videos. We'll give the audience a clue. The clue sort of drops down and then letters start to randomly fall, eventually forming the nuclear term that we're challenging our audience to guess. This next example is we're trying to take advantage of an established hashtag on social media, hashtag TBT or hashtag Throwback Thursday. In this example, we're asking our audience to guess who the scientist is in this photograph related to nuclear, Glenn Seaborg, by the way, what element he's credited with co-discovering and which element he's pointing to on the chart below. So we're always kicking around ideas for these types of posts because they're fun for me to do and creative, but also because they're popular on our social media sites. And the numbers that I look at in terms of gauging success of our posts bear out that these are solid engagement numbers on these types of posts. So lastly, that brings us to crisis communication. I wanted to start with preparedness. So how do you communicate with people, with the public in a crisis? A recent Pew survey says that 1 in 5 U.S. adults say they often get news from social media. So we're compelled to occupy space in this territory. If we want to be a reliable source for information in a crisis, then it's important for us to do the work now in a non-crisis environment to establish, cultivate, and maintain our presence on these channels. So a couple of examples of preparedness, folks. On the left is a screenshot from a video we produced that gave our audience sort of an inside look at the NRC Headquarters Operations Center. On the right is a Facebook post that we did to highlight a regional exercise in our Region 1 office in Pennsylvania. So we've incorporated social media into our crisis communication plan. We simulate the use of social media at national-level exercises involving other federal, state, and local agencies, as well as at our headquarters and regional exercises. We have a mechanism in place for dedicated social media monitoring in a crisis, and I've observed an exercise from a licensee facility. And all of this is to say that we understand how important social media, how central it will be to successfully communicating in a crisis. On the last slide, I wanted to give you some real examples of crisis communication response. Now, this isn't a nuclear or radiological crisis, but rather a severe weather event that happened this past season, a hurricane that affected some NRC-licensed facilities. So on the social media, this was a smaller scale opportunity for us to use social media to keep the public informed about what was happening at these facilities, what we were doing at headquarters, what our regional staff was doing, and what our resident inspectors on site were doing. So on the left is a Facebook post that we put up showing that our incident response center in our Region 2 office in Atlanta had been stood up for 24/7 monitoring. On the right is a tweet that I sent out conveying that a nuclear plant in North Carolina and a nuclear fuel facility had shut down operations due to the storm. Below that is a screenshot of a Google alert where a local media publication had picked up our tweet, resent the information to their audience, and said that a nuclear plant had closed, and this was according to NRC's Twitter account. So we know the information we're sharing on social media in these types of circumstances is definitely going to reach a broader audience. So in the meantime, we're going to continue to try to create content that we think is relevant and useful and appropriate in social space using these strategies and others. So that's a peek at NRC's social media program. We do discuss adding tools to our program portfolio, but we're careful to consider our resources and other challenges to creating that quality, consistently creating that quality content that I talked about. Thank you. I just wanted to say real quickly, they're going to hopefully switch over to our Twitter feed because we've been live tweeting from the RIC for these past several days, and in fact, are tweeting from this session today. So just want to give you a look at it.
Are we blowing up the Twitter? Right? Anyway. So thank you to all of the panelists. Now comes the fun stuff. We'll take questions from you. I also have a few of my own, but starting with your questions, and this is to address all of the panelists.
Could you discuss how your organizations deal with the issue of trolls, and we might also just refer to it as sort of negative commentary, on social media platforms? So, Sebastian, do you want to start?
Fortunately, we do not really have much problems with trolls in Switzerland. not we as regulator. There are other organizations that have more problems with trolls, but we don't have really problems with trolls. And the times we have such people writing things in our on our joining our posts, we normally ignore them.
Ignore them. Okay. Gino.
Yeah. To an extent, you know, we haven't had much trolls, but there were a few incidents, and we have basically a social media policy that positively basically states that in order to manage negative perception, or if you have a bot, etc., we'd assemble a team that will evaluate the content rather than the messenger. So based on the content and the merits of the content, whether it's material, whether it deserves a response, we will respond accordingly to that.
Chiwei?
Me? Also, I'd like to say, so far, I did not see such a thing. I think maybe Taiwanese is kind, I think. So actually, I don't have such a practical example for that. But I think we also have a policy on social media, but we only have the Facebook. So I think maybe so far it's still good, I think. That's all I can say.
So maybe this is primarily a U.S. problem, because I know Stephanie can address it.
Yeah, we have some people that are pretty passionate about nuclear on both sides of the issue. So we have some very clear comment policies for our social media sites. But honestly, you know, looking at it all, we don't have that many people that troll us. Again, people are passionate, and they do have opinions, which they're not afraid to express. When we find that they've blatantly violated our comment policy, we'll take their comments down if we need to. We've only had to, I think we've had to ban only one person from our Facebook page since 2014. So most of our commenters are very respectful, if not passionate and opinionated. So
the biggest issue that we tend to face is, where is the line of what's a personal attack and what's an attack on a personal opinion? Attack on a personal opinion is okay. Attack on a person is not. So often, Stephanie and I are kind of parsing the language to see which side of the line it falls on. We prefer not to take content down, but we won't tolerate personal attacks. Okay. All right. Next question. This is also for everyone. The users of Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn are very different users. Is there a need, or do you change or adapt the content of your posts depending on the social media platform that you're using? So, Sebastian, you've got LinkedIn and you've got Facebook and Twitter. How are you adjusting your content?
Not enough yet. That's something we have to develop more. We started 2011, and during crisis situation, because we had a communication crisis situation 2011 after Fukushima in Switzerland, political situation became very difficult for us. Those who were against nuclear power, use of nuclear power, were getting strong and tried to destroy our position, to destroy also the use of, to accomplish their mission that nuclear power wouldn't be used anymore in Switzerland. And so we started to use social media to multiply our information, and to push it to the people. So when we published something on our website, we used social media also to point on this article on our website. Later on, we started to tweet, to do live tweeting out of our press conferences. The first time we did it really live tweeting, so listening to the things that our experts were saying and then writing our tweets. The biggest lesson learned was prepare your tweets in advance, also the slides you want to add to this tweet, for example. So this was already a step further, and on this way we had the lead in informing about this press conference. But I think we really have to go further, think more about what is the audience in the different channels, and also what are the possibilities of the different channels. Twitter is short, Facebook gives you more possibilities, LinkedIn is more experts. You've seen we have on Facebook, we have a very small number of subscribers. I think it's just because it's difficult to like in Switzerland everything that's linked to nuclear. So there's certainly still a lot of work to do.
Gino, how do you adjust your content?
Yeah, pretty much. I think Sebastian touched on quite a bit. What's important for us is relevance and capability. You can also frustrate certain audiences using certain channels with unnecessary messaging that might not be relevant. Case in point, if you look at LinkedIn, the very nature of LinkedIn is a professional network, speaks to careers, et cetera, et cetera. And it will depend on the message that you're trying to get out and to whom. In our case, we do a lot of outreach, and our outreach is more on edutainment aspects and creating awareness amongst various groups, multicultural groups. That might not necessarily be of interest to someone on LinkedIn on an academic profile. However, we do send it in bits and pieces. It's customized messaging that wouldn't irritate the recipient. And then, obviously, like Sebastian mentioned, the capacity of the channels. Twitter can take in so much of words, LinkedIn, and the profile of Facebook. So it's on a case-by-case basis, limited, and as per audience-specific. Because not all audiences want to hear about everything, and in this day and age, I think it's more like a spam, and we want to avoid that. That's our approach.
Chi-Wei?
I think it's lucky. So far, we've got only Facebook. Yes. But actually, maybe because of culture, we like to convey complete knowledge. So maybe the Twitter is inappropriate for us to convey our information or knowledge. Yes. But also, we have another approach, like I just introduced. We use the meeting or some discussion to communicate with the public. Maybe they could get more complete, more, I would like to say, appropriate, not correct, maybe appropriate knowledge or something we want to do. They will get familiar with the content we'll try to discuss or try to speak. Yes. So far, I think maybe actually we have another way to communicate. Yes. So. Actually, Twitter or LinkedIn, I think it's okay, but so far we don't use the way. That's all.
Understood. Stephanie.
I think the biggest difference is we can say a lot more on Facebook, more character space. But I find that our audience on Twitter is a lot more serious or focused on the day-to-day regulatory business of our agency. So I find that those tweets that we send out about news releases that we put out are generally more popular on Twitter. So we do adjust. We don't post all press releases that we do on Facebook, only if they're sort of high profile. And of course, I think on Facebook, we try to be a little bit more conversational. That's where the more creative or entertainment-oriented posts are more suited to a Facebook audience than to Twitter. We do try to cross-pollinate as much as we can. If we think it's useful on one of our channels, then we think it's likely to be useful on others, but perhaps adjust how we write the message, the language that we use in each one.
Great. Thank you. All right. This is also a question for everyone. Do you post technical information on your social media channels? Do technical experts or communicators write the posts? So this is a good question about technical information on platforms that tend to be a bit more informal. So, Sebastian.
We publish also technical information, but we do it in we try to write this information as much as possible in plain language. And that's the struggle I think every communication expert in a regulated body has, to find a balance between what technical experts want and what the public needs, because they talk different languages. It's the social media posts are written by communication experts, but they are based on what we publish on our website, and these articles we publish on our website are always produced in collaboration with the technical people.
Yeah, no, upfront we don't. I'm not sure. It's actually a very interesting question to look at the future of it, you know, because the nature of what we do as regulators, one can ask, you know, how do you... It has its own challenges, I think. It's an interesting environment to actually explore. I mean, you have the links option to link to technical papers. Then you have the... I guess it'll eventually come down to what you're trying to achieve, you know, whether you want to push and pull, whether you want to consult, whether you want to, you know, in our current environment globally, is social media good for decision making, or does it influence decision making? In the FMCG area, the private sector, a lot of marketers use insights from social media. It comes at a risk, but I'm sure there's more intelligence, you know, being gathered to say, you know, how do we mitigate this risk and minimize it? Because we're throwing money at it at the end of the day in terms of product. But in terms of nuclear safety and regulation, it's going to open a whole new can of worms. But long and the short, no, in South Africa, we haven't even touched or even considered using social media for technical information.
And so far, we don't have such experience because technical issues, or maybe it's not easy to use on the social media. Because we think the technical issue maybe needs to more deeply discussion. And now we got the Facebook, maybe in the future we'll use another way of the social media. We would maybe the target we want to do is to promote the knowledge, not the technical issues, I think. I mean the public knowledge, not the technical issues. But I think maybe it's... Now, more and more people use social media to communicate some, not only the technical issues. I think maybe in the future that would be the good way to communicate our public, such as safety issues or some regular activities, I think.
So we, for our social media, we're pretty centralized, so most of the content that is officially NRC information on social media comes through the Office of Public Affairs. And so we, while we do get input from staff around the agency and content from them, we do make sure that it's written in a plain language kind of way, just because we know on social media it's sort of inherently informal. So we try to write in that way. There is some technical information in our posts, specifically if there's a current issue that we're talking about. But again, we try to keep it as simple as possible in the social media post itself. But of course, we'll link out to information on our public website that gives our audience an option to dig a little deeper on a particular issue or get more technical information than what we really want to put on our social media sites.
All right, now I have a couple questions that are directed at individual folks. So, Sebastian, you're first up. Can you speak about how you use LinkedIn?
As I explained already, we are not at the situation yet where we should be to separate the different channels and publish in a way that is more appropriate to each channel. We use LinkedIn at the moment like we use more or less also Facebook. On Facebook, we sometimes do also a bit more. Giving the main message of an article we published on our website and then link to this article on our website. It's really interesting to see the last couple of months that LinkedIn is, for us, the fastest growing channel at the moment. Long time it was Twitter. Facebook, as you have seen, is on a small level, on a low level. But LinkedIn is growing quite fast at the moment, and also the views of our posts are still growing. So that's, for me, it's an indication that we're not completely wrong what we're doing.
And I have one for Gino. This is an interesting one. In Africa, when a government shuts down the internet, are any users able to bypass that and still access the internet another way?
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm not the spokesperson for Africa, but I did inquire about that question, and the research indicates that the way Some folks up north in Nigeria, in that area, were trying to access internet offshore in the east, in Asia. So connectivity is an issue. But as far as I know, in South Africa, we haven't had the issue of an internet shutdown, but our neighbors did. And in order to have connectivity offshore, it comes at a cost. So it's not a very practical thing for a lot of Africans. So, Holly, I must confess up front, you know, I'm not aware of any solid cases. What I am sharing with you is what I've read in the research, that there were some individual groups trying to access the internet via offshore. I think soon it will become more accessible to everybody to have. It's another interesting dimension of having internet access, infrastructure for internet access. If you look at the aircraft industry, you know, the Malaysian airline disappearance, the technology now has improved where that there is almost a guarantee that the location of any object in the air would be at constantly being monitored without any black holes and gray areas. And this is done by a satellite from the top instead of the traditional, conventional pinging of the aircraft. So hopefully that kind of technology will make internet access globally accessible to everybody.
And one for Chiwe. Can you tell us a little bit more about what a fan page is and how you use that?
Okay. As I mentioned, the fan page of ourselves, I just mentioned we just promote the popular knowledge on the fan page, but we also promote something like what we do, what we're going to regulate, maybe some new inspection activities. We also put on the Facebook fan page. Also, the fan page of the government have another usage to. I don't want to use the promote the word. Maybe to get the people know what the government wants to do for the people. I think the fan page from the government, they usually want to gain the public trust in government. Yes, I think. But we will like to use the fan page to transfer, like the nuclear energy, the hard to understand the technical items or terms to easy to read or lively picture words on the fan page that could get the audience easy to know what the nuclear is, maybe the energy policy of our government, like this, these issues, I think. We are not really, that's how we use the fan page so far. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. All right, and Stephanie, can you talk a little bit about how you determine success of your social media platforms, how you look at the metrics and...
Sure. I do pretty regular reporting for my own management, weekly or monthly reports that sort of indicate to them what's been successful in that week or that month. I do a comprehensive report annually that really looks in depth at the content that we've posted over the year. So, you know, we're not trying to drum up business with our social media or make money off of it. So the truth is that some stuff that we post, we're always going to post, regardless of how it performs on our social media sites. So when I look at the metrics or the analytics that I look at to determine success, I'm looking for the stuff that we've done right so that I can do more of that. And the creative posts and stuff that I talked about in my presentation were part of that. So when I'm looking at it, of course, views and audience size are important to me, but really the most important thing is the engagement numbers, the shares or the likes, the retweets and the comments, because that tells me that not only did the audience take the time to look at the content that we posted, but they decided to go a step further and do something with that content beyond just viewing it. So I really kind of focus in on that metric for gauging success and try to keep creating content that serves that purpose.
And this question actually piggybacks a little bit on what Stephanie just said. So this would be for the other panelists. Have you evaluated the growth rate of new users and followers? And then sort of a subsequent question is, what is your plan to expand or get more followers? So how are you evaluating your platforms and looking ahead?
That's a thing we do regularly, especially I have to report this to the management at the end of the year. It's a basis to show what we have done. There is still a growth, but as I said, nuclear is not anymore so interesting in Switzerland after the referendum of 2016, so the growth level has decreased. I think numbers are not the only thing. Quantity is not the only thing. It's the quality of your followers. So it's important that you reach those who are valuable for your messages, that they can help you by multiplying it or because it has an influence on their decision. So for us, it is important to reach, for example, the members of parliament. It is important to reach journalists. But at the end, for the rest, especially after the referendum of 2016, nuclear has become an aspect of a closed user group. It's not like football or soccer that interests everyone. It's, yeah, as long as there's electricity and there's no accident, never mind. So that makes it a bit difficult. So there is not really a plan to work hard on expanding the number of followers. For me, it's more important to have in the group of followers those who are valuable for me.
Thank you for that. We use the Google Analytics, you know, and we use that data to inform some of our activities. And we also mirror that, the feedback on, to assess the effectiveness of our outreach. We have a large outreach drive, and we find that social media platforms helps us to connect to the previously disadvantaged learners, particularly, to stimulate interest in math, science, technology, and engineering. So our key drive in terms of reaching out to our audiences is to drive the education awareness bit. Because in order to sustain a nuclear program, it's long-term, and we all are facing the skills crisis as the aging workforce, you know, completes its end. We need to have pipeline skills. So our thrust and our drive is on that, how Google Analytics informs us. And I know, Holly, you might have another question about some barriers in how we interact, but I'll wait for that. So, yeah, we use Google Analytics, and our thrust is mostly learners from senior high school right up to university level.
First, the number of followers, I think, is not so important because, one, we're not celebrity. And the other one is maybe the content about this kind of boring, I think. Yes, but actually, we still have another way to reach our audience. I think, like we said, the open meeting or I just mentioned two platforms to reach our audience to get there to know how we are doing something like the regulatory activities, I think. Yes.
Thank you. So now there's a question for me. I don't think that's allowed, but we'll go ahead and do it anyway. Why did the NRC stop using its blog? So I think it's an important conversation to have with any of us. What return are you getting on your platforms? Social media is resource intensive, and you've got to constantly be evaluating what's working, what's not working, what new platforms are coming up that you've got to consider. And we evaluated the resources that went to the blog and decided to throw them to Facebook. And with Stephanie's guidance, we have greatly expanded our Facebook reach and our engagements, and we're really quite happy with how that platform is performing. From time to time, Stephanie and I will sometimes look at what else is out there. Every now and then we say, God, do we need to be on Instagram? But so far we have not found an additional platform that we want to add to the program that we feel is worth the extra resources that it would take to maintain. But let me throw that to you all. Are any of you considering additional platforms to add to your existing program?
That's a constant work of my online responsible, analyzing, are we on the right track, are we doing the right things. At the moment, there's no need to change platforms. We have had already a couple of discussions on Facebook, but phasing out of Facebook is a bit difficult, not technically, but you giving it up is a difficult decision, and it doesn't cause us much work to be on Facebook. We have had already discussions on Snapchat, Instagram, but Snapchat seems not serious enough to be there as an administration, as a responsible administration, and Instagram lives from pictures, and we are working in a business that doesn't produce much nice pictures. We are not the Kardashians so we cannot publish each day a selfie. That makes it a bit more difficult. But to reach younger people, that would be the channel number one at the moment in Switzerland.
Mm. Any of my other panelists thinking of adding a platform?
No, you?
Me. And besides the Facebook fan page, we are starting maybe 2 or 3 years ago, we start to put, we have the YouTube channel. We like to produce less than 3 minutes short video to introduce maybe the same content from the fan page, but we also focus more more technical issues like the what the nuclear power is or the, what the atomic, like another technical items. We would like to make the short film and put it on the YouTube channel to reach more audience or the public to know about what the nuclear power is. Yes, that we are trying to do that.
Okay. All right, on to the next question. Again, this is for everyone. Do you encourage your employees to be active on social media? Do you have any established guidance for their social media activity?
No, we do not encourage them. And that's there's just the official channel of ENSI, or the official channels on the different platforms. That has also to do with bad experience we had in the first couple of months after Fukushima, that especially journalists tried to find the differences between what the officials said and made the stories about that. So there is a one-voice policy at ENSI, and we have just the channels of ENSI. I know from other countries in Europe, especially, for example, Finland, was doing it completely different, and I think it's really a quite interesting way of working, and I would love to have that also in Switzerland, but therefore you have to change a whole culture in your organization and bring them also to this new tools of communication. And unfortunately, I have to say, at the moment, and most of the people working at ENSI are not really so familiar with social media and so on. So maybe it's something that comes in the next couple of years.
Yeah. We in South Africa, we have a policy and a guideline. Now, the very nature of the word social media, when employees look at it, how do you tie this to work? You know, my time is my time. Why must I comment on work stuff on my social media? You know, and that is a perception. So it will take some time to getting used, like all new technologies and innovations. So we have a guideline, but we are not at the stage where everybody can be commentators, and everyone can respond. Our media policy does not allow for that at the moment. Maybe we're conservative, maybe we're waiting to see and learn from countries like Finland, where everybody is responsible for communications, but no, we're not at that level.
Actually, the answer is no. but actually, we'll have another way. We like to communicate these such things inside the organization. But as I mentioned, when we're doing something on over the social media, we try to say more issues about the public, related to the public, not our job. Yes, there's kind of difference. Yes, so I would say that we want to encourage people, our people, to do the communicate or say something over the social media, I think.
Stephanie?
I think, I don't know if we really encourage or discourage people from communicating on social media. That we do have a policy in terms of, you know, officially representing the agency as an NRC employee. I'd say that we do encourage employees to contribute to our social media efforts as much as they can. I think it's a good way for people to highlight the work that they do at the agency. Obviously, they're very proud of what they do, very good at what they do. So whenever we can share it on social media, we certainly encourage that. And then, of course, encourage them to look at what we've posted and share that if they can, if they think it's appropriate. So in terms of people's personal use of social media, I don't think we fall on either side of that, but do have a, some guidance that, that says what is appropriate and what's not.
All right. This is a question that has to do with crisis communication. So it says GINSCOM, which I always stumble over, focuses on non-emergency communications. Has anyone developed best practices for emergency communications? With the advent of social media and its ability to perpetuate inaccurate information, have you established policies or platforms for distributing accurate information in emergencies? Sebastian?
The biggest challenge in an emergency situation are resources, especially in communication. And you saw the numbers. We have 150 employees at ENSI, 4.2 full-time equivalents working for in my department for communication. In a crisis situation, in an emergency situation, I can have some more people working for communication. So you have, in a crisis situation, to reduce your channels and focus. And we trained on focusing on our website and on Twitter. We have to publish, and that's also an additional challenge for us. We not only publish in one language, we have to publish in three languages. So that means in German, in French, and because if we have a real emergency, we have also to publish in English. And then we are forgetting the third language in Switzerland, Italian, but we do not have resources to publish in all three languages in our country. So we will focus on the three languages, German, French, and English, and on the channel's website and Twitter. And the other channels we would just, in the hottest phase of an emergency, we have to forget this, the Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube. It's not possible.
Dino?
Yeah, in terms of the GNSSCOM, the IEA GNSSCOM, it's a resource network for non-emergency situations. Now, I am not sure what the plans or what the IAEA has in terms of emergency communication. I'm sure they do, but I'm not aware of it.
About the emergency communication, I think in our annual drill, we also have the practice about the emergency accident, but it's a practice. And we also put it such a communication on Facebook. The Facebook only set up by during the practice, and we use the Facebook to communicate the, I would say, the actors, not real public. Yes, that we try to test our skill how to do communicate with public when the power plant have some accident or some crisis situation, I think. Yes. But so far, I think the situation we're practicing, I think so far so good, because we have some background or some ready to do the steps protocol to help us how to combat the communication with public during the crisis. Yes, so I think so far it's all good. Yeah.
Stephanie.
Yeah, we do have strategies. I mentioned in my presentation that we've incorporated social media into our crisis communication plan. I think what's tough for me is in the artificial environment of an exercise, everything happens really fast. The exercise is over in 4 hours, and so I'm constantly tweeting, trying to get all the information out. That's probably not what it's going to be like in a real event. So The lesson for me is, in those times where we don't have any real information to put out on social media, or any new information anyway, is to make sure that we have other content that helps our audience who are still going to be looking for information, and we don't want there to be a vacuum. So we do have a strategy. We have some pre-written material as much as we can. Obviously, in the beginning of any crisis, things would be fast moving, and we want to make sure we're prepared for that. We have some pre-produced public service announcements that we would put out, and then, of course, cross-post. We do have other Holly could probably speak to this a little bit more, but we have a sort of a dark emergency web page that would go live in the event of a crisis, and on that web page, we would have some sort of rumor control area where we would be, you know, of course, monitoring social media for misinformation and trying to correct that on our website. And then, you know, of course, using our social media tools to keep the public as informed as we can, but understanding that we, as an agency, as the NRC, need to stay in our lane in terms of what we say on our social media. So, you know. Perhaps Holly can.
I just wanted to expand a little bit on the rumor control page. So we recognize, you know, social media is a good news, bad news scenario, right? So the good news is, in a crisis, it gives us platforms where we can communicate directly with the public. The bad news is we know that the rumors on social media will be, you know, just overwhelming, and nobody can catch up really with the rumors. So we stole an idea from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and in a real crisis, they would augment our social media monitoring, and they would be looking for the big rumors that are circulating, and they would feed those to us. And then we would put them on this rumor control page. We have a little thumb up and a little thumb down as to whether or not it's true. And then we would put along with it the information, you know, the factual information as we see it. And then we would tweet every addition to the page. So it's our way of trying to combat rumors. In addition, a lot of our pre-prepared materials, messaging, PSAs, that sort of thing, pushes people towards official source. So we continue to say, make sure you're getting your information from an official source. And we do have language that says, be careful what you're reading on social media, some variation of that, in recognition of how pervasive rumors can certainly be in a crisis.
May I?
Yes.
For me, it's also quite interesting. From my point of view, the most important tool for us still will be the website. And it's quite interesting to see that as soon as there's happening something that might have a link to nuclear, we have an increase of numbers of visits of our website. Even if it's far away or it has not a direct link with nuclear. We had, for example, it's about 2 or 3 years ago, not really a strong earthquake somewhere in central Switzerland. And what happened? We had an increase of numbers on our website. Then there were, a couple of years ago, rumors on an accident or troubles with a nuclear power plant in the Ukraine. What happened? We had an increase of numbers of our website. So that, for me, that's also that shows me that the website is quite important, but it shows also that we gained this position that if there's something in nuclear or more or less linked to nuclear, people know where they can get reliable information. They come to us. And that's something we have to maintain.
So in the interest of time, we have one last question I'm going to pose to all of the panels, and I'm going to broaden it a little bit from what's posed. The question reads, how do you deal with fake news or inaccurate facts put out by other organizations or people? And I'm going to broaden that, I think, a bit to how do you respond? Do you respond directly on posts, either on your own platforms or others? Do you get into what I would call a Twitter war? Or do you sort of not respond when there's inaccuracies that relate to you?
And that's our last question.
That depends on the source of this fake news. If you would react on each fake news that's published online, then you would permanently be in a reaction mode. And you would also support them to distribute, to multiply their fake news. So it depends on the source of this fake news. We normally, if it's a source that has a potential impact on the audience that's important for us, then we prepare with enough background, a reaction, and sometimes that can take a couple of days. But then our reaction has a weight. Can also be quite quick. If it's, for example, in the media, then you have to react faster. But we have, for example, if an anti-nuclear NGO publishes a report with a lot of mistakes in it and fake news in it, then it doesn't make sense to react half an hour or an hour later, because you have to prepare a counter-report. And to prepare this counter-report can take some time. But then our reaction has a weight.
Yeah. Responding to fake news, you know, I think earlier on Stephanie's presentation, you know, she said with the use of social media prior to an incident taking place is very important. You say you need to build the credibility and the trust of your stakeholders as far as possible, reasonably achievable. In our instance, we use retweeters in the shape of key stakeholder groups who we have WhatsApp groups with. So if there is an incident of fake news, we'd correct the news based on the facts, and we'd allow retweeters to share and spread the message. That's as far as we go.
Most of the time for us, we do the response on our official website. According to our observation, most of the followers is to follow our website, not the fan page. So like we just mentioned, the rumor control or some misinformation, we have the special zone to post our response to, especially to some misinformation. Yes, that we use to do the response on our website. Yes.
Stephanie.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think we at the NRC prefer sort of an organic conversation. As much as we can stay out of the fray, we do. So I've found that when somebody particularly is on our Facebook page and commenting and putting out information that that may not be entirely accurate, other people that follow our Facebook page pipe in and say, well, that's just not true. Or sometimes they're a little bit mean about it. But so we prefer that kind of conversation. I think also, I lost my train of thought there.
Well, we don't respond directly on Twitter. So we might do a Facebook post.
That's what I was going to say.
On the topic,
right,
that we feel was misrepresented in some way. But it's not a, you know, neener, neener kind of thing. It's just presenting information. So we don't think that it's productive to get into, you know, one-on-one right, platform fistfights. So we try to avoid that. All right. I'm going to thank all of my panelists. You were wonderful. Some of you traveled very far. We appreciate it very, very much. And if you don't mind joining me to give everybody a round of applause.